wasn't the end of it.
Okay, the Economic Development Housing Budget Division for Monday, February 22nd, will come to order. We're going to do some more overviews of the governor's budget recommendations that came out last week.
See, that's what I thought.
And so let's start out with the Department of Commerce. Mr. Janky here. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Sir Chair, Tim Janky, Financial Management Director for the Department of Commerce.
Okay. And once again, members, as you can see on the agenda, there's a page number that is pertinent to the testimony that's going on in front of us. So this one's page 37. Mr. Janky, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to give a little bit of an overview here. Page 37 is the correct page in the governor's budget, and we're really going to refer to the first two items here initially to start off with, the operating budget reductions and the program grant reductions. However, those numbers are totals for our agency and not specific to the purview of your committee. It includes Senator Anderson's energy items as well. I did hand out to the one of the staff a page that looks like this, so that you can that'll help kind of narrow down the items that we're discussing today.
Okay.
First, I'll just start off. The governor's office requested that we look at funds, operating funds, and look to calculate a 3% reduction in those accounts and 6% from our grant accounts. The fiscal year 10 calculations were to be based on unexpended balances in the accounts, not uncommitted, not just the uncommitted funds. The fiscal year 11 calculation was based on budgeted
amounts.
Wait,
say that again.
It was based on the balances, the cash balances in the account. And in addition, it was uncommitted funds in the account. So in other words, if we had committed them for grants or other types of expenditures and the money hadn't gone out the door yet, we were to look at those and include those in the calculation. I'll start walking through the sheet here, and if there's questions, we'll entertain those as we go along. The first reduction is in the administrative services area, 66,000 reduction. And I'm sorry, the amounts on here are negatives, even though they're positives, but these are reductions. $66,000 reduction in fiscal year 10 and $126,000 reduction in fiscal year 11.
And that equates to a 3%, 6%?
Those are both calculated as 3%. The first, just to orient you a little, the operating reductions here, the first two columns are fiscal year 10 and 11 operating. That's 3%. The second two columns here of fiscal 10 and 11 are grants, and that was calculated at 6%. So those are the reductions in our administrative services. Our commissioners asked us early in the year to begin holding positions. If individuals left, we've been holding some positions vacant, kind of knowing that the reductions would be coming. So we'll have some available funds in fiscal year 10 to handle this. In 11, we'll continue to keep some of those positions open and probably move one of our staff to our agency indirect cost account to try and minimize the impact on our administrative services area.
How long have these positions been open?
Pretty much all, Senator Tomasoni, pretty much all year this year they've been open. When we've had individuals leave, it's been at various times, but we've held them open for, you know, the bulk of this fiscal year.
Are these a result that somebody retired or somebody moved on or it was just vacant at the start of the budget year or what was it?
Mr. Chair, a combination of. We've had some, at least one retirement, one individual left of their own accord, and we had one open at the beginning of the year. We just didn't fill.
And are these positions that you generally feel need to be filled?
Mr. Chair, We've been dealing with those as best we can and reallocating some staff to the more important functions in our admin area. But we're kind of getting down to where, you know, if we have to have any further reductions, we're going to, it's going to start hurting a little bit more. And we may have to look at other ways to reprioritize to make sure we get our highest priorities done.
And so as a result of these vacant positions, for the most part, you can reduce your operating budget without laying anybody off?
Mr. Chair, that's our plan at this point, is we don't have any planned layoffs in our admin area.
Sorry, keep going.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, the next item is our operator reduction in our market assurance division, $124,000 in fiscal year 10 and $196,000 in fiscal year 11. Last session, the market assurance division received additional funding for some additional positions for compliance and those positions are, some of them have been filled, or a few of them have been filled. We've also had some retirements in that area. So we have a number of open positions or vacant positions at this point. And we handle it much the same way as we did in the admin services area for market assurance. The next group here is appropriations under the petroleum, the petrol fund. In sum, the totals to $569,000 in fiscal year 10, $32,000 in fiscal year 11. The first account here is $25,000 out of their operations. This is the account that pays staff salaries, rent, and operational cost for the petrol fund operations. The other accounts here are open appropriations out of the petrol fund that would be reduced, and these funds would then be transferred to the general fund.
How does reducing your operating budget affect your ability to collect fees or the amount of money that comes into the agency as a result of reductions in the operating budget? Does it have any effect on your collections?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the market assurance reductions or?
Either one.
The market assurance division, well, Deputy Commissioner Munson-Ragala is here and can specifically address the market assurance division.
Welcome. We're just checking to see if you're going to still be able to collect as much money as you normally can.
Understood. Okay. Mr. Chair, Manny Munson-Ragala, Deputy Commissioner for Market Assurance. We're going to have to prioritize our attention on frauds and cheats and scammers as opposed to technical violations. I mean, that's what we're going to have to do. What would that all mean in terms of the fee we generate? I would think there would be minimal impact because the fees we're going to generate are going to be things like licensing fees, registration fees, and some fine generated. But we never project how many fines we're going to allocate since we're going to spend our or collect, I should say, since we're going to spend our attention on violations that will likely yield a fine. I would expect that we're still going to generate roughly the same amount of fine activity we've been historically generating.
So have you fixed my glass problem yet on cars?
Fortunately not.
So is that one of the ones that you're going to ignore again? Or?
I don't know if ignore is the right word, Mr. Chair. We're going to be collecting data and opening files on all of the complaints we receive. But we're also telling some folks, frankly, if we don't have enough information to proceed, that we're collecting the data just to be sure we have information in our system. If we have allegations that someone stole money, we're going to spend resources on that.
Okay. Mr. Jenke, go ahead.
Okay.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Well, I was just wondering, Mr. Chair, is the part of Commerce that deals with consumer protection, Mr. Munson-Ragala, is that under the jurisdiction of our committee? Are we going to hear about that, or is that just something that would be discussed in Commerce?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we have a Bureau of Consumer and Industry Services, that's the area that includes our frontline consumer response team, the folks that handle the complaints, the calls, try to mediate claims with insurance companies, for example. Mm-hmm. That staff is not being reduced. That staff is staying as is. To follow up on a question that the chair had, our reductions are contemplated by not filling positions, and fortunately, most of our open positions right now are on the investigation side, not on the consumer response side. So that's where the vacancies, for the most part, are going to come out of.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzen.
There, I should know this, but are there more petroleum cleanup dollars? Isn't that the outside of this at 3 or 5 cents a gallon or something? Money is available for it. This isn't all the money for petroleum cleanup stuff. This is administration and what have you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the Pollution Control Agency also receives some funding, but I'm not sure on the specifics of how much or what they get or how they use it exactly.
But there's so many, Mr. Chairman, many problems out there in this area, and we're certainly not going to catch up to the problems with this these small amounts of dollars, are we? Are there other pots, the pollution stuff? Does that make sense to you? I mean, there's a lot of issues out there in this area.
Mr. Chair,
there's got to be more money than this for 569, right? I don't know that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, we maybe have somebody here that can, Jim Pearson, our deputy commissioner, can maybe help out a little bit on that question.
I mean, I don't want to belabor the thing, but I think
he knows where all the dead bodies are, so he can.
Yeah, where are the anybody living after these cuts?
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, my name is James Pearson, and I am one of the deputy commissioners at the Department of Commerce. The Petrofund program does sit as part of my responsibility at the Commerce Department, and the number there certainly is a significant number. However, it will not effectively hamper our operations. We have enough money in the fund to continue going forward, and the number of releases has come down over the years. So I think that number is a manageable number.
Okay, that thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's good to know, because we're probably getting there, aren't we? Someday, I mean, we're going to get to where we need to be, where the cleanups are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, absolutely. That is the hope. The concern, obviously, is new releases do occur. We still need to address those, but certainly the trend is trending down, and that's what we hope to see with greater prevention efforts and coordination with the Pollution Control Agency.
And then, Mr. Chairman, you had a lot of problems that I'm aware of were in the first ring suburbs where 60, 70 years ago anything would go, right? I mean, the newer communities, well, they go by the new rules and what have you. So I would think the St. Louis Parks and others like that would be trying to catch up. All right.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, one item that gets to your earlier question about the recovering of costs, one thing you'll note isn't on here is any reductions to the financial institutions area. They fully recover their costs, so the governor's office or the governor's proposal chose not to take any reductions in that area, given that they fully recover their costs, their general fund costs. Moving on to the next section down here are some special revenue accounts. The first one on the list here is the license technology surcharge account. We have $34,000 reduction in fiscal year 10 and a $52,000 reduction in 11. All of these accounts or all these amounts in these special revenue funds would be reductions in the account, and those funds would then be transferred into the general fund. The license after that is the insurance fraud prevention account of $64,010 and $48,011. The auto theft prevention account, the amounts listed here, $37,000 of operating and $15,000 respectively, and then $96,000 in grants that would be reduced.
Is that 50 cents? On our insurance policies?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
It's supposed to teach us to lock our doors when we and take our keys when we get out of our car. Is that what that one is?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And are we still teaching anybody to do that, or is it just a cash cow now?
Mr. Chair, there's a large chunk of grants that are allocated to local units of government to help them stem auto theft prevention. We don't administer any that programmatic activity. We really move that out to those local units of government to spend those dollars in the way they see fit. Maybe Deputy Munson has some.
Munson.
Mr. Chair, the Auto Theft Recovery Fund pays for things like dummy cars, decoy cars, special investigative units at counties or cities focusing on auto theft. It's a grant program, so they make a grant proposal every year. We review the grant proposal. We'll just have less dollars to give out. So
dummy cars? You try and trick people into robbing the car? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yep. With, you know, kind of like homing devices, for example, embedded into cars.
Oh, boy. We got to get rid of this program. Senator Olson.
Well, I was just going to share, Mr. Chair, that a few years ago, I think the one and only NCSL I've ever attended since I've been here, they talked about Minnesota as being kind of a hub for washing titles, I guess would be a way to say it, and promoting. We have a high percentage of people who either come here and steal our cars or come here and wash titles for stolen cars, because we're not part of a federal network of states that where there was some federal money out there. And basically you would be online with sharing title-related information based on VIN numbers of cars. Apparently we never really got into that when the other states did, and so that was the reason we had a problem with a lot more activity in this area. I don't know if we've done anything since then to correct that issue, and I'm just wondering, you know, if that continues to be a problem, if Mr. Munson-Ragala knows whether we have a higher incidence of that kind of thing continuing to happen here and a reason to be concerned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know the answer. I will find out and get back to you.
Thank you.
So are you insinuating this program is not working?
Well, Mr. Chair, I really, you know, it's a related issue, but it's not exactly the same issue. It seems to me that putting money into getting up and online so that we could talk to other states and prevent this from happening here would probably, you know, be a better way to try to prevent than dummy cars, you know, maybe trying to. But I'm just wondering if anyone's looking at the whole picture to see if we're really dealing with this as effectively as other states.
Sounds like those deer the DNR put in the forest that.
Yeah.
Try and trap hunters into
deeks.
Decoys, yeah. Yeah. I figured you'd wake up on that one.
She's stupid.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next item is the real estate education research and recovery account. $49,000 reduction in fiscal year 10 and a $5,000 reduction in fiscal year 11. The mortgage originator consumer education account, $7,000 reduction in fiscal year 10. And the last account on here is the HMO regulation account. It's an interagency agreement we have with the Department of Health, $4,000 in 10 and $9,000 in 11. The total $516,000 of special revenue accounts that would be transferred to the general fund.
Okay, now, if I understood you, the numbers that are underneath the operating fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11 are 3% and 3% of the funds that are unexpended at this point in time, correct?
Yeah, correct.
And then the grant lines, the $96,000 and the $7,000, those are 6%.
Correct.
Okay. And these are grants, so the grant lines are the grants that have not been expended yet or have not been obligated?
Mr. Chair, they may have been obligated, but they have not been expended. In this case, I don't believe the 96 or the 7 have necessarily been obligated, but I can check on that for you.
Okay. If 6% is $96,000, is there a great big pot of grant money that hasn't been obligated then? Is that what we're saying here? I mean, is there 94% of the grant money that hasn't been obligated?
Mr. Chair, I can check on that for you and see what is unobligated grant money in that account.
Okay.
Get back to you.
Okay. All right. Any questions or is that Senator Metzen?
Well, nothing to do with the this fund, but you talk about things that don't go away. We had a tire cleanup fee years ago, and the tire problems have been solved. The $3 has not gone away. And we also put out in 1983, when we were broke, a $5 surtax for patrol cars. And they don't go away. But that's all right. They're used, it's money well spent somewhere else. I know that. Just an observation. You're talking about fees that you put on that don't expire.
And I've never liked that insurance one, but are you talking about the recycling fee now, the $3 on tires? That, like, for when you change your tires and get new tires, yeah. They charge you $3 per tire to recycle it. Is that what you're talking about?
I think we've cleaned up those tire pits, if you will.
Mr. Chair,
but the fees still are.
I'm not familiar with our department collecting those fees. I'm not sure if that was something that either that we used to and we don't anymore, but I've been with.
Well, I think you do, but they're just kind of buried somewhere, okay. But that's all right.
Okay. I wonder if pollution control collects them.
Mr. Chair, that's a possibility, but I can try and find that out as well.
Senator Koch? No. Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, there's just a couple other more policy items that have fiscal impact here that refer back to the governor's pages, the page 37 you referenced earlier. It's on the bottom of page 37. It's a federal licensing system. Mortgage originators, there's been a new federal mandate that mortgage originators, the individuals, are to license through a new federal system through the, it's called the Secure and Fair Enforcement for Mortgage Licensing Act. We've been told by the feds that we are going to be part of this. They've requested us to, or maybe more strongly than requested us, that our share of that system is $400,000. We've included a $400,000 increase in expenditures to become part of that system, and we'll recover those costs through an assessment on the mortgage institutions in the state.
So Chapter 58 is mortgage institutions, is that what that is?
Correct. Mr. Chair, I'm not the expert on that, and we can get you more information if you want, but my understanding is currently we license the mortgage institutions in the state, but not the individuals. This is a requirement at the federal level to license the individuals as well.
License the individual?
Individual mortgage originator. Okay. Currently, we just license the company in the state. Okay. We have two other policy items on page 38 for small dollar impact policy items in the market assurance area, and Deputy Commissioner Munson-Ragala can walk through those two items.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the first policy item is a attempt to clarify our intent with respect to changes to the Model Security Acts. When we adopted the last set of changes in 2006, it came to our attention that some folks were interpreting the new revised Model Act to not require notice filings for certain types of 506 filings, securities filings. That was not our intent. We decided that we needed language to clarify that the status quo should continue going forward. We tried the best we could to price what a return to the status quo would be. And we were projecting somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 in additional filing fees. The second policy item that has some fiscal impact is currently under a continual education system. If you take a course that's not otherwise pre-approved, you can make a filing, $10 a filing, requesting us to look at the course that was not previously approved and get approval for that one course. The 11 grand we're getting approximately a year doesn't cover the time for our person that has to do the work. So our thought is, if she's going to be spending a lot of time on CE, which she is, we'd rather have her spend time in areas where she can do things like get turnaround for course approvals for hundreds of people, as opposed to spending the same amount of time for a course approval for one person. So our recommendation is to eliminate the ability to get individual course approval, but that would be roughly, we guess, $11,000 loss.
Okay. And so that is across all your continuing education programs? Is that what you're saying, or just one in particular?
I believe that's primarily on the insurer side.
Senator Dibble.
I have to quibble over what seems to be a small item that makes some sense, but my question is, how would this employee know which classes to look at? I mean, I can just well imagine that this is going to be frustrating to these 1,100 folks who don't have a way to make this request going forward, you know, unless, of course, you know, someone has taken some proactive step to approve a, I mean, how will she know what classes to take a look at, or are we just eliminating a service period?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, before you take a course, there's typically a requirement that the course indicate whether or not it's been approved by us or not. So our issue has been folks taking courses they knew in advance were not approved, and then anticipating that they could convince us after the fact that they should get approval for the course. Most of the providers that do business in Minnesota do file for approval prior to the course being offered. We're trying to expedite that process so that folks can get access to CE, more CE that's approved, and then more locations and more topics.
So this because when I read your narrative here, it has nothing to do with somebody who's taken an approved continuing education course but didn't file it and then asks for a retroactive approval. Does it have nothing to do with those?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It's just for courses which were not approved in advance. They're now asking us to approve them after the fact.
Okay. Can you give me an example?
Someone might be on vacation, stop in and see a seminar on real estate condo sales, for example. Might think it's worthwhile, attend a luncheon seminar, and then we'll submit the material to us to get one credit approval for one course.
And it might have been an approved course in Florida, but it might not be an approved course in Minnesota. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, the last item on here is just the on allotment ratification of $247,000. The amounts have already been removed from our fiscal 10 and 11 budgets. And this is just pushing those out into the out years. Of that $247,000, $150,000 is a reduction to market assurance, and $97,000 is a reduction to our administrative services area.
Okay. Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Radzak. I am the manager of community engagement at Minnesota Public Radio. I am joined today at the table by Jeff Nelson, who is Minnesota Public Radio's managing director for public strategy. Thank you for having us today. As Minnesota's largest cultural organization, Minnesota Public Radio's broadcast signal is available to 95% of the population of the state. Every week, more than 950,000 people tune in to NPR's three regional services, classical, news, and the current. For an average of 6 hours, Minnesotans spend 5.7 million hours listening to NPR each week. We are here today to update you on progress we are making with our FY Fiscal Year 10 General Fund Equipment Grant, and to tell you that Governor Pawlenty's supplemental budget proposal zeroing out our FY11 equipment grant would have very real consequences for communities in northern Minnesota, not the least of which is losing nearly $600,000 in federal funding. Before I turn it over to Jeff, I just want to direct your attention to the handout that is going around that lays out the picture for the amount of state funding that is invested in the construction of the stations in northern Minnesota, as well as the federal funds that are being dedicated to the projects as well. And I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Nelson for more details on these construction projects.
Thank you, Mr. Radzik. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nelson, and I'm the Managing Director of Public Strategy for Minnesota Public Radio. First of all, I just want to thank you for the commitment you made to Minnesota Public Radio and the statement of faith you had in entrusting us with state funding during the last legislative session. As you know, Minnesota Public Radio uses the equipment grant to extend our coverage to parts of Minnesota that might not be able to support a public radio station by themselves. In particular, we focus on parts of Minnesota that are defined by the federal government as needing first service, or they don't currently receive Minnesota Public Radio service or the service of our colleagues at the Amper stations. So we're always looking to find those areas where they have no access to public radio and all of the information services that we provide, and also emergency alerts and the other important services that public radio provides in the state of Minnesota. With FY08 and 09 funds, we were able to launch a new station in the Roseau-Warroad region that is currently operational. We made the commitment of state funds that were appropriated during the last legislative session to build new stations in International Falls, Hinckley, and Ely. And unfortunately, with the governor's recommendation to zero out our FY11 funds, we find ourselves kind of between a rock and a hard place. The rock is the FCC. When you get a station from the FCC, they grant you a license for a particular frequency, and then they give you a construction permit. And that construction permit has a deadline. You can't miss the deadline. If you don't build the station by that deadline, you lose the permit, and you're not going to build that station. That is a hard and fast rule. The hard place is federal funding. Because we're providing first service to some populations in the state, the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting have committed $600,000 to these projects. If we lose state funding, unfortunately, we will find ourselves cutting a check back to the federal government because the state funding is being matched by more than one-to-one. So we're finding ourselves in a situation where we're rethinking these projects and trying to find out what we can and cannot do. Unfortunately, if we lose all of our funding, we're going to find ourselves with two half-built stations, and it's likely we'll not be able to build the Ely station. In International Falls and Hinckley, we've purchased land, we've started construction, and in Ely, we're about to do that. And so we could really find ourselves in a situation where the state money that you've already committed to us, that's already spent, will go to waste, and we'll lose, again, over $600,000 in federal money. As you know, we cannot use legacy money for this, so we're not. There are no other sources of funding, certainly, that we are aware of. And I touched on this earlier, this is not just about providing NPR news service to parts of greater Minnesota. This is also about Amber Alerts, about the EAS system, about other emergency alert services that we need to make sure every citizen in the state has access to. With that, we can answer any questions you might have.
So the issue is kind of twofold. You have some federal matching funds. Well, three, now that I think of it. The FCC doesn't reissue these permits.
Right, unfortunately.
And construction might start and not be able to get finished if you don't have the money.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. The challenge with the FCC is, in order to avoid speculation on licenses for radio stations, the FCC created this deadline system where if you don't get the deadline, if you don't hit the deadline and build the station, it's not operational, you lose it, and you have to reapply at the next window, which might not happen. So we really are in a position where if we don't build these stations, they're not going to get built.
And you're not here saying to us we won't want to be cut at all, although you would like that, but you understand
no,
the situation
we certainly,
we're in.
Mr. Chair, we understand the situation that you're facing, and we certainly understand that there are going to be cuts made across the board. But certainly 100% is disproportionate compared to what other agencies and grantees are looking at from the governor's recommendations.
Senator Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know, what is the total biennial budget for NPR, and then what percentage of that is state funds, including the legacy dollars?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, the total budget for Minnesota Public Radio is roughly $78 million a year. And this year, we received $250,000 for our equipment grant and $1.15 million for our legacy grant. So it's less than 2% of our overall budget.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, if I missed it, forgive me. But how far along are we on each of these stations?
Mr. Chair.
Nelson.
Senator Dibble, in International Falls and Hinckley, in International Falls we've purchased the land. There's some negotiation that has to be done with the DNR around the tower, but we're in the process of building the tower. In Hinckley, we were actually able to purchase an existing tower, so we've purchased the tower and the land that the tower sits on, and we're in the process of installing the transmitters. We have not begun construction on Ely, although we have a lease agreement for a tower there. There we're actually leasing tower space as opposed to building a tower. We always are trying to find the least expensive way to build these. In some cases, it's buying the land and building a new tower or buying an existing tower, or in some cases, leasing space on an existing tower.
So it's safe to say we're, Mr. Chair, kind of midstream on all of them.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, at the International Falls site, that the DNR doesn't have anything to do with the wetlands, does it?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, I'm not aware that it's a wetland issue.
It's
relatively routine, and it's on land where we're allowed to build a tower. There's
okay.
just some.
All right. Great. Thank you.
And so then, so let's just say the governor gets his way. What is the result? I mean, what happens to the money that's on this sheet here?
Mr. Chair, first there would be a very serious meeting down the street, and we would have to look very seriously at how to best reallocate funding, and we would probably give up one or more of the stations to preserve the others. And in particular, just looking at the federal match, we would try to maximize federal dollars coming into Minnesota, and so we would move funding around. I can't tell you specifically what we would cut and what we wouldn't, but I know that if we lose the FY11 funds, it would be a very serious discussion. We'd probably lose at least one of these stations.
And would you at any point have to refund federal money that you already have?
The Mr. Chair, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting money we have in hand. So in that case, we would be cutting a check back to the federal government. The NTIA money is secured, so we have it. We have access to it as the construction process moves forward. We wouldn't actually be cutting a check back, but we would be releasing that money back to the federal government if we did not build any of these stations. The federal money can't be moved around, so we can't say to the federal government, you can see the money they've appropriated for each of the different stations. So if we don't build one, we can't use that money for a different station. That money just goes back.
And these expiration dates, those are the dates that you have to have it done by. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And you'll see those are both coming up in 2010 and 2011. If we could, if we had more time on those permits, we would push these projects back in the face of a significant cut. But unfortunately, We can't do that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhag, the FCC has zero regard for Minnesota winters and International Falls, so it doesn't matter if it's December and 60 below zero. They want it done.
I understand.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Any other? Anything else we should know?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, then.
Thank you.
Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Station, AMPERS.
AMPERS.
Senator Saxhag.
Mr. Chair, one of those you're familiar with, KXE in Grand Rapids, takes care of the range of Bemidji and Brainerd.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gullickson.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Chairman Tomassoni, distinguished senators. For the record, my name is Jim Gullickson. I'm the AMPERS president and the manager of KMSU-FM at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, or AMPERS. I've provided you with a packet, a modest packet of materials that gives the coverage map of the various AMPERS stations, as well as some support of the testimony I'm about to make today. AMPERS stations have received state community service grants and equipment grants for over 30 years, since 1980. And over this period of time, the Minnesota State Legislature has wisely recognized the importance of these stations as valuable resources for their communities. The legislature has also consistently recognized how vitally important these grants are to individual stations. These stations provide radio service needs that are not met by commercial broadcasters. State grants provide a very important part of the financing for AMPERS public radio stations. The AMPERS stations vary considerably in size and in budgets, and the state grants make up from 2.3% in some case to 36% of state budgets for these stations. Here are just a couple of examples of the significant impact these grants have on the operating budgets of AMPERS stations. The governor's suggested cuts would force some stations to drastically reduce or even eliminate labor-intensive activities, such as live broadcasts for major events, coverage of state and local activities, and even employment at the AMPERS stations of students interested in pursuing a career in broadcasting. And I can say, from my perspective, my particular case, we do have students who would be impacted by this. The stations will not be able to offer the variety and depth of cultural and minority programming that serve unique listener groups in the communities served by public broadcasters. I would call your attention to one item in that handout. The one that looks like this talks about KMOJ being a very unique public station here in Minnesota serving the Twin Cities. Stations would not be able to stay current with technology, which is constantly changing, as you well know. And the stations that train public broadcasters, well, that means not having the equipment that these folks would use in their jobs after they graduate. And unfortunately, some stations would most likely have to lay off employees or significantly decrease the hours of work the stations have available and decrease the quality of their broadcasts. There's an extra added burden for the AMPERS stations that receive grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting should these important state grants disappear. CPB grants require non-federal support, so AMPERS stations that use these state grant dollars, they actually leverage those dollars in order to obtain those CPB grants. So this is vitally important to the stations that qualify, and if they were to lose those matching dollars, it could mean they wouldn't get the CPB grants, and that effectively would impact jobs. People would not be able to be employed any longer. These state community service and equipment grants ultimately make it possible for bright, creative Minnesotans to work at AMPERS stations and serve their communities. Now, as the distinguished members of this Senate committee all know, in November of 2008, Minnesota voters approved the Legacy Amendment to the state constitution. AMPERS stations were ultimately granted an estimated $2.65 million over this current biennium to enhance the arts and cultural heritage for all Minnesotans, and we have not taken this responsibility lightly. Moreover, in crafting the language, which was part of our application process for the arts and cultural heritage grants, we were very deliberate in making certain that these dollars would be used to create new or enhance existing programming and vigorously improve arts and cultural access for all Minnesotans, rather than going toward general operating expenses. Part of our reasoning for this was the specific language in the amendment that prohibits these funds from being used as a substitute for existing state funding. Well, as our record has demonstrated since the inception of the state community service and equipment grants programs, AMPR stations have been and will continue to be excellent stewards of these funds. Now, I recognize the seriousness of the current and future budget issues facing the state of Minnesota, and I know our record demonstrates that AMPR stations have shared in the necessary sacrifice during previous economic downturns. And this is what we are asking of you today. Please do not accept the governor's recommendation to zero out the state community service and equipment grants to AMPRs. I implore you to instead treat these excellent radio stations as you would any other worthy recipient of precious state resources. The AMPR stations are prepared to equally and equitably share in the sacrifice, but as you've learned today, elimination of these funds entirely would be disastrous. Thank you for your generous time and attention. I would entertain any questions.
Any questions, comments? You mentioned the legacy funds, but the legacy funds, really, you can't really use them in conjunction with the state funds that you get, right?
No. We were very careful in our application process to make certain that if we were awarded those funds, that we would use those to create new programming, enhance current programming, do things that basically hadn't been done before because we never had the resources to be able to do them before. So we are doing that, and we're delighted that we have those resources available. But we still have to operate in terms of doing pledge drives and seeking out underwriting support and all the other things that we had to do before the same way. And so what it really did was create an extra level of responsibility for all these stations, but did not create a windfall, if you will, on covering the operating and overhead expenses of the radio stations.
Now, I know that you're not supposed to use legacy funds to substitute current funds, but there's got to be some kind of obvious bridge between what you're doing and what you're going to do. I'm thinking that state funds actually affect the ability to use the legacy funds. Am I wrong about that? I'm not sure.
I think to answer the question, and of course I know our situation better than perhaps my colleagues at various other radio stations because we're all a little bit different than one another. But in our situation, should these state grants disappear, be zeroed out, we would be in a very precarious situation in terms of just meeting our operational objectives. We would very likely have to curtail some of the programming that we have been able to traditionally bring to our audience. A number of these programs are syndicated programs that we don't produce locally. We purchase, and we'd have to eliminate those. We just wouldn't be able to afford them. And they're high quality, and it would be a disappointment to our audience, and it would be, I think, a lessening of, you know, the vitality and the richness of our radio station. I can say that from our perspective. Now, I can't say that for all of the different AMPR stations because we're all different than one another. But we all really strongly rely on these operating and equipment grants, and frankly, to some degree more than others. But certainly in our case, it would be a pretty big blow.
Okay. Any comments or questions? You're looking at me like you have a question. Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gullis.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Last one today is Twin Cities Public Television. Welcome to the committee, and each one of you state your name for the record before you start your testimony.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Senator Tomasoni. A bit of a correction, we represent not just Twin Cities Public Television, but all of Minnesota Public Television.
I see that. I appreciate that correction, too.
my name is Alan Harmon. I'm general manager of WDSC and WRBT, the
so
public television.
So who's responsible for Miami, then? Is it just Minnesota Public Television, or is it Your Emmy, I guess it is.
No, but, I should have brought
that down here. Sure. I know, but we're not on television today, so.
No, the Iron Age History Program that produced your Emmy was produced by Twin Cities Public Television.
It's the Emmy I have in my office, but I think it's your Emmy. But okay, but anyway, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Alan Harmon. I'm General Manager of WDSE and WRPT, the public television stations which serve Duluth and Hibbing. I am also President of the Minnesota Public Television Association. With me today is Mr. Bill Sanford from Lakeland Public Television, serving Bemidji and Brainerd, and Mr. Les Heen, Pioneer Public Television, serving Appleton and southwestern Minnesota. We are, frankly, happy to be here today representing America's most trusted media. That the finding of the recently released Roper Public Affairs Survey, and that a distinction that public television has earned for 7 consecutive years. I was struck by the irony of the governor's budget announcement eliminating funding for public broadcasting, in that it came in the same week that Roper survey identified public broadcasting, in particular public television, as the second best use of tax dollars in the opinion of the American public. The first best use was defense, and that meant that public television ranked above those essential services such as fire and police and public education in terms of use of tax dollars. It's from that perspective that we appreciate the opportunity to share what elimination of those funds as proposed by the governor means to public television and Minnesota. The budget items being eliminated are core operating dollars. They pay expenses for operating engineers, utilities, replacement parts that all stations incur regardless of their size or their programming. That means these are not discretionary expenditures, and the loss of funding for them means something else has to give. The proposed reductions come on top of a $1 million reduction in biennial appropriation for public television from the previous biennium. So we have already shared the pain, if you will. The impact of the elimination of state funding for public television is amplified by the loss of matching dollars. Each of the public television stations serving Minnesota is qualified for CPB funding. A portion of that funding is determined on a matching basis from non-federal sources. Minnesota's funding counts towards those matches. Without these funds, it is inevitable that there will be cuts in our services to our communities and to your constituents. That means cuts in jobs. For my station, Minnesota appropriation represents about 10% of our budget, more importantly, about 20% of our personnel expenses. And frankly, those are the expenses that we can control. Loss of funding for WDSE, WRPT would mean that we would no longer be able to produce programs like candidate forums, our doctor's calling program, our gardening calling programs, our high school art and essay contest just concluded last week, drawing 1,200 entries from high school students attending 24 schools across northern Minnesota, and our Young Writers Contest, which is the most successful in the nation, drawing about 10% of the entries for the entire nation from northeastern Minnesota, about 4,000 K-3 students participating in that program.
You say writers or writers?
Writers.
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 Yeah.
Writers and illustrators. We provide curriculum material for the teachers to use in the schools to teach children essentially how to put together a story and illustrate it, and then submit those to the national contest.
How do we do?
We have done very well. We had a national winner from Eveleth a year ago.
Whoa.
And
that's really impressive.
And interestingly, writing about another Minnesota institution, his time at Target. So we have definitely a local interest and a local success story there. For the smallest of our stations in Austin, the state appropriation represents 20% of their annual budget. Elimination of the state fundings would mean having to cut production of several of the weeknight series that deal with health, that deal with social and urban issues, that deal with farm issues, and the program Entre Amigos, and you'll excuse my Spanish, but obviously a program aimed at serving the Hispanic community in Austin and Rochester. The biggest of our stations, Twin Cities Public Television, which has already seen 13 individuals laid off over the past 2 years, would have to cut those programs that don't have separate grant funding. Those are programs like Almanac at the Capitol, programs serving minorities, including programs dealing with education, health, and safety issues for the minority communities. Again, programs that are difficult to secure funding for in this current environment. Mr. Sanford and Mr. Heen can describe the situation at their stations themselves.
All right. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today, Senator Tapassani and committee members. And speak a little bit about Lakeland Public Television. We serve a really large geographic area. We serve basically from about Little Falls all the way up to the Canadian border with two full-power TV stations. In a lot of this area that we serve, we are the only television station that provides...
Tell the city slickers how far that is from Little Falls.
It's a long drive. I'll be in the car 8 hours today to be here to talk to you. So Senator Olson knows a lot about that and others from the north.
Well,
so.
And, I mean, I'm 4 hours, 4.5 hours, depending on how fast you want to drive away, but then your service area continues to go north of me for probably at least another 3 hours.
Yes.
So, you know, that's... That's a very big part of the state that would be without any local news station.
Thank you. You know, as I said, we cover a really large geographic area, and the one thing that's kind of unique about our coverage area with Lakeland is most of our coverage area, we are the only local TV station that's providing any local programming. And I'm not just talking about public TV. I'm talking about TV station, period. There is no local news once you get north of the Little Falls area. We are it. We do a nightly newscast. We're kind of a unique public TV station. We invest a lot of resources in doing that. Close to 30% of our staff work either directly or indirectly in our news area, so it's a big investment for Lakeland. In addition, we produce a lot of programming. We produce almost similar number of programming hours per year as Twin Cities Public Television, and we do it on a budget that's about 10% of their budget. So we've got a staff that works very hard. We not only produce nightly local news, but we produce a public affairs program out of our Brainerd studio. With the investment of the legacy money, we're doing more arts and cultural programming now, and we very much appreciate that. We do legislative coverage. We do debates during the election cycles. In fact, I think the last time we did that, we did about 13 one-hour debates live during prime time on our main channel. So we don't push that off to the side. We feel that that's important. And I think a lot of the elected officials realize the value of that. And I think for a lot of the people up in that area, that's their only opportunity to be able to hear their legislators speak when they're going through the process of the election. So it's a good opportunity to get their voice out and so people can vote and make good decisions. So I think what Lakeland is doing is a really important service in the area. You know, I also talk to families quite often, and we're talking about some pretty poor areas. Clearwater County, I think, is one of the poorest areas in the state. A lot of the folks that I've talked to lately are facing a lot of pressures just like the state financially, and they're making cuts. And they'll drop cable if they're in town, or maybe satellite TV if they live out in the country. Now that Lakeland Public Television is broadcasting 5 digital channels, we've got a kids channel, we've got a non-kids channel during the day, so there's good things. We carry your House and Senate stuff gavel to gavel. So it's an important service, and people rely on it more and more as they're being pressed financially. You know, if the governor's elimination indeed does come to pass, We will most likely end up having to drop Lakeland News at 10. That's where our discretionary money goes, is to support that newscast. And that would mean the elimination of about at least 5 full-time staff members in Bemidji, 2 more in the Brainerd Lakes area. So we would lose about 7 people on our staff. And that's assuming that we can continue to maintain all the underwriting that we have now. And I know a lot of the underwriting support that we get is around news. So I would expect that we're going to see some additional losses. Al talked about the fact that federal matching dollars are based on what we raise locally, and state dollars count for that local match. So we're going to get hit on that side, too. As everyone said, we understand the state situation. We see it up there in our own households throughout our area. The things are tough. Times are tight. We're not asking for anything more than anyone else, but being zeroed out and being eliminated seems pretty harsh. And we would, gladly accept our share of the pain as we have in the past, but elimination is pretty tough. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Bill, but I just don't think I can emphasize enough what this means to people in northern Minnesota who are served by Lakeland Public Television. As has been stated, this is our only local news channel. And, when I came down here to the metro and first started turning on the television, if we ever got home in time to do that, I guess I was really kind of blown away by how much local news there is in the metro area. I mean, there's a lot of coverage down here from many different directions. When this is the only thing you have to rely on, losing that would be like losing the one thing that keeps people informed of what's going on and kind of keeps people together as a community. When I was back home over the weekend, I was at several different community meetings. And of all the things in the governor's budget that we talked about, this was the one that people were the most upset about.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Les Heen, and I'm the general manager of Pioneer Public Television, which also reaches a large area. Our headquarters are in Appleton, but with towers near Worthington and Fergus Falls, we reach an area roughly from just north of Detroit Lakes to Laverne, so roughly 1/4 or 1/3 of the state, depending on how you count the miles in there. The governor's cut would represent to us about 12% of our total budget, but if you look at it as compared to our staff budget, it would be roughly 1/3 of what we spend annually on salaries, taxes, and benefits. And that would be where the disproportionate share of the cuts would have to come. I expect that this would mean a loss at Pioneer of 5 jobs. And while we certainly, as Bill said, all of us understand the challenges that the state faces, I think it's important to share some of what's going on right in Appleton right now, which is where our people are employed. The community of Appleton, as many of you know, recently had a prison close. So we have a community that's recently gone from 150 jobs at its largest employer down to 7. And so in a community of 2,800, the loss of another 5 jobs is significant, to say the least. In addition, the $230,000 or $223,000 cut that the governor has proposed would also affect our non-federal financial support. As the other people you've heard have said, it is those state dollars that count toward our federal match. And I can tell you that there is a minimum floor of federal match. And if you don't reach that federal match, it jeopardizes all of the federal money that you could receive through CPB. So if we don't, this cut could put us potentially with the other declines that Bill had talked about in underwriting and other areas, it could put us below the federal match. So a cut of $200,000-some could mean wiping out $600,000 in funds that we would receive from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So the loss there would be severe. In terms of its effect on programming, programs that have been around a long time, such as Your Legislators, Prairie Yard and Garden, and Prairie Sportsman, I expect would all be cut. And I should say that Your Legislators has been around for 28, 29 years, and Prairie Yard and Garden has been around for about 20. So these are programs that have been around for a long time and very much beloved by our audience. While we don't do daily news the way that Lakeland does, we do public affairs. And I can tell you that the people, particularly in the southwestern corner of the state, the area around Worthington and Slayton and Laverne, I've talked to a number of people over there who have said that if it were not for pioneer-caring programs such as your legislators, they wouldn't really know much of what's going on in St. Paul because all of their news comes from Sioux Falls. That's where they get their TV news from. So we are their source for those for that kind of information. In addition to that, of course, you know, the funding cuts would come at a very difficult time because underwriting and membership dollars are challenged because of the recession. So what we are looking at is a situation where $1 in state cuts could end up being $3 in state cuts. So it's a difficult time. Also, of course, we do appreciate the legacy funding that we've received, but as you've already heard from several speakers, the legacy money is not meant to pay for the light bill. So we certainly appreciate the fact the state's in a difficult situation and that cuts are necessary, but as Mr. Sanford said, 100% cut is really too much.
You said $1 in state cuts is equal to $3 in state cuts. Did you mean
$3 in federal?
Federal,
yeah.
Cuts. Okay.
Yeah, because if we lost all of the federal money, Mr. Chair, that's what it would be.
It's interesting how this all works because if I added it all up, you all said if you actually get cut this much, you might lose between 15 and 20 jobs, I think, amongst the three of you, and it's an indication of how things go in the wrong direction when you make cuts in state funding and instead of creating jobs, you destroy jobs and put people on unemployment rolls. And so I understand where you're coming from, and we'll do our best to figure out how to do this right because I don't want to see people get laid off in this jobless economy that we already have. And I don't know, I think we heard, what did we hear, Senator Metzen, 250,000 people on unemployment the other day.
250 on UI.
Yep. So, Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your comments. I guess I'd like to, at least partially support some of the things that Senator Olson said. I think public television in my district, which covers, about 30% of Congressman Peterson's district, or, well, not that much, but quite a bit of it. I have seven entire counties that are all in the Pioneer Public Television's broadcasting area. And I got more comments, I think, on trying to maintain funding for public television than I do just about any other topic that comes up here at the legislature. I don't know what percentage of the people in my district watch public television. They have quite a variety of offerings, but it does seem to me the people that watch it are very committed. I think I could easily rack up 65 names that have contacted me on this aspect of the governor's budget cuts. So I just wanted you to be aware of that, Mr. Chair, and know that it's important to a lot of people.
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm a star in Southwest Minnesota because of my appearances on your legislature. So I can't cut off my access to my public. Well,
you're not running for governor, too, are you?
Let's see. What kind of ballot would that be when you get elected?
Yeah, very, very remote. Yeah,
he would be the governor.
My own constituents don't know what a superstar I am down there.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Any closing comments? Okay.
Yes, if I may, Senator, I just did want to call your attention to the packet that we passed out. You mentioned job loss. We have documented those losses in the packet. Also in the packet, details of that Roper survey. Just want to close by noting that some 85% of Americans think that the money going to public television is well spent, and that truly the elimination of these state funds is not trimming fat, but cutting into muscle and bone. Arts and cultural heritage dollars. We appreciate having received those, but need to point out that that's not all that we do. We provide, we help explain science. We provide information to citizens to improve health, And we think we play a role in helping to build democracy, both by educating young folks and providing information for voters. So just to reiterate, we understand tough decisions. As managers, we make them every day. We understand that you have tough decisions to make. We just appreciate the opportunity to explain why we think the governor's wrong on this one.
Okay, thank you. Senator Metzen.
I was just thinking that Senator Dibble's a legend in his own mind.
but he might be a star in southwestern Minnesota. You never know.
Go anywhere without being mobbed now.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Metz and Senator Dibble may not be the only one around here that has that.
That's probably true.
And I just found out, Mr. Heen, that you used to work for Senator Stumpf?
Correct. I was Senator Stumpf's committee administrator from 1990 to 1996.
Ah, really? Okay. So did you get a big raise when you moved on, or?
Well, actually, it was a trip between from there. I went to the university and then to Farmers Union, and now back to my first job, which is broadcasting. So I was out of broadcasting for 17 years.
Okay.
And he lives in my district, Mr. Chair. So be kind to him.
Put him on your committee. He can help you out. Okay, any other questions or comments from committee members? Okay, thank you all very much. And
thank you for the opportunity.
You can see what a tough job we've gotten trying to figure out this budget. So I think I made an announcement at the last meeting that we were going to have something done by the end of this week, but it looks like we've slowed that down, and we're going to wait to see what the forecast is. And I think there might be some negotiations going on at the House also before we decide what the final cuts are going to be. So, Cap, no meeting on Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, members, there is no meeting on Wednesday. We are waiting for some more finalization of maybe targets, and we don't have that many bills in division. There will be probably meetings next Monday and Wednesday. And in addition, I think we're going to have an invitation next Monday morning to visit the set of The Convincers, which is a film being shot in Minnesota, the production, not by the Coen brothers, but by Works. Their executive producer testified before committee last week, and I think that will be down at the St. Paul Depot, but I will have more information to your offices by either this afternoon or tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you all very much, and meeting adjourned.